Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, vegetarianism, in Western cultures at least, is on the rise. More people are choosing not to eat meat, although globally it's a bit more of an opaque picture. There's no doubt, though, that in the West, adopting a vegetarian diet has been one of the top trends for the food industry to consider in recent years. But the history of vegetarianism is anything but recent. It goes all the way back to ancient Greece, and probably more, through persecution during the early Christian period, two world wars, and right up to the present day. So buckle up for a story with more twists than a spiralised courgette as we delve into the history of vegetarianism. And I'm delighted to be guided on that journey by the perfect companion, Richard McElwain, Chief Executive of the Vegetarian Society of the UK. Hello there, Richard.
Hello, Stefan. Delighted to be here, yeah.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to have you. Now, let's start off back at the beginning. I mean, I guess one of the first known vegetarians and animal welfare advocates was the Greek philosopher Pythagoras, and he lived around 570 to 495 BCE. None of his writings have survived, but he is thought to be the first known vegetarian, really. Can we think of him as the father of vegetarianism?
I think so. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, there are some writers who believe vegetarianism goes way back beyond Pythagoras, but you get to a point where recorded history really
runs
starts.
And
of course, most of us will know Pythagoras from school in terms of that, whatever that equation was, the sum of the square of the two sides, etc.
Yeah.
But really, yeah, he was one of the first people, particularly in Western civilization, who was sort of preaching, advocating for a vegetarian diet. And, you know, he was actually, when you look at Pythagoras, the school that he set up, he was very ahead of his time. Mm. You know, he was very much into women's rights. You know, he had a school which is a bit more like a monastery, to be honest with you. You know,
very ascetic lifestyle.
Very
there.
Ascetic, great word. So lots of vigorous exercise, lots of clean living. And of course, you know, vegetarian diet was a part of that. And I think there were two aspects. One was a health reason, which obviously is very prevalent today. And the other one was an animal rights reason, which, of course, is very, very prevalent today. So they really did see animals as sentient and intelligent and worthy of looking after rather than just raising and slaughtering for food.
Mm. Now, none of his writings survive, but that doesn't mean that we don't know what he thought. I mean, the same thing can be said for lots of important historical figures. Do we know what the inspiration was behind his thoughts on eating meat?
Yeah. So, you know, really, at its heart, he was a great believer in that animals should be treated as sort of sentient kindred creatures, very much ahead of his time when you think of the way that animals have been brutalized all the way through known civilization.
Mm.
So, yeah, he sort of, there was a sense that if they are sentient and capable of feeling pain, then we ought not to inflict harm on them. And of course, that therefore requires that you don't kill them for food. So, the next logical step from that is that you follow a vegetarian diet, or as it became known, a Pythagorean diet through many ages. And it was just one component part of healthy living in some ways. You know, the people who were around Pythagoras did live fairly austere lifestyles. You know, they were very much into health and well-being and exercise. And as well as wanting to take care of animals, there was a sense that actually a vegetarian diet was also healthy.
Mm, he could charge 60 quid an hour for that these days,
couldn't he? Absolutely, he could. Yeah, indeed. Online, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And do we know anything about the influence that his views on vegetarianism had at the time? I mean, he was sort of persecuted towards the end of his life. I mean, we think he may have died during this persecution. But did he affect other people around him?
Yeah, he certainly did. A number of other philosophers, obviously those in his school to begin with, but other philosophers, not just contemporary, but also following him after his death, adopted the principles, not just of vegetarianism, but the principles of his way of life, this idea of a simple life, a good life. And, you know, even going through to sort of the late 4th century AD, you can still see writings, the Platonic philosophical schools have sort of Pythagorean thought at their heart. So I think it'd probably be I don't, it'd be a stretch to say he dramatically influenced Western civilization, you know, because you've got the Roman Empire was kicking around at the same time and not known for its kindness and charity to animals. but yeah, certainly, you know, his thinking did survive the test of time. And, you know, as we go further, you see his influence even coming forward through to today.
Mm. Now, it's relatively easy to be a vegetarian these days. Was it back then? You know, I guess it's an extension of hunter-gatherer culture. You know, was pretty civilized by the Greek period. But was it easy to be vegetarian back then? And if so, what would a vegetarian diet really consist of?
Yeah, relatively straightforward. I mean, it certainly would have been what many people nowadays would call a whole foods vegetarian diet.
Gruel.
Good gruel. Gruel. So a very classic vegetarian diet that you could see in the early 20th century, to be honest. So lots of grain, milk and dairy, small component parts of milk and dairy. And there's a whole other debate I'm sure we'll come on to about, you know, vegetarian versus veganism. But nuts, seeds, berries, fruits, vegetables, I think it would have been a diet that was very familiar to us. Mm-hmm. I think the bit that wouldn't be familiar is the distinct lack of processing. So some of those foods would be served purely in their raw form. There would be combinations. Clearly, there was a very basic processing, salting, curing, drying, but nothing like the ready meals that we see in major supermarkets today. But yeah, not hugely unfamiliar.
They must have fantastic stools.
They probably fairly gargantuan, I think. Yeah. Lots and lots of fibre. Lots of trips to the toilets.
Yeah, very good.
Well, very healthy. Good, a good gut biome, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. Now, around the same time, Buddhism was starting to grow in India and vegetarian is central to its teachings. Has vegetarian always been led by big thinkers like this, you know, magnetic personalities or prophets? Or has it sometimes just been a necessity?
I think vegetarianism from an ethical and philosophical point of view is a way of life. Absolutely. The big thinkers of the time were the people who were propagating this. So we've talked about Pythagoras, of course, Siddhartha Gautama, you know, the Buddha, very famously vegetarian, but actually, of course, himself leading back into time. You know, you can go further back to, you know, Jainism around the same time, but Hinduism and the Vedas within Hinduism. They don't suggest that vegetarianism is a component part absolutely of following the Hindu religion, but it is an important part and seen as a good thing to do. And that stretches back well before the Buddha, of course. But yeah, I think when it comes to thinking about vegetarianism in the context of health, well-being, animal welfare, the concept of a good and simple life, absolutely. It's the philosophers and the thinkers who are really developing this. I think other people who are almost having to follow a vegetarian diet, even though they would really like some meat, but simply, you know, times of war or times of poverty, that it simply doesn't stretch that far. Yes, it would have been a necessity, but I don't think it was seen as necessarily a good thing in that context. I suspect they would have really valued you bringing around the local goat if they could have done
a bite of him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I used to have a vegetarian girlfriend, and she was, you know, we sat down, not so much anymore, a thoroughly carnivorous wife. But she, we used to sit down for dinner, and inevitably somebody would start having a go, basically having a go at her for being a vegetarian, saying, so why are you vegetarian? And there had to be a conversation, and it really upset me, because I kind of thought, why do you have to justify yourself? She just wants to sit there and eat. Yeah, let's talk about something interesting and funny, rather than dragging her through this again. I wouldn't say this is persecution, but it leads me on to say vegetarians have been persecuted for their views in the past. Can you tell us a little bit about this and how some vegetarians were treated around the time of early Christianity?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is the old joke, I think particularly with vegans, isn't it? You know, how do you know there's a vegan in the room? Don't worry, they'll tell you. and I think that sense of a slightly holier-than-thou type attitude has probably led to some of that persecution. But I think also, I'm not so sure, particularly in sort of early Christian times and all the way up to medieval times, that vegetarians were persecuted per se for being vegetarian. It was more that vegetarianism was a component part of what was deemed an heretical lifestyle. So, you know, you've got the wonderfully.
There's a warning sign that you thought differently.
You thought differently. You were outside the prevailing norms at the time. And of course, this is a time when, probably far more so than today, that religion and power were very intertwined. And religion was a way of enforcing and retaining power, particularly by kings and bishops and the various. So, you know, stepping outside of that was seen as somewhat, I was going to say heretical, but actually, you know, almost treasonous in a way. So you have the wonderfully termed Bogomils, who are a Bulgarian sect who were persecuted, burned at the stake. You have the word I can never say, the Manichaeists, wonderful Iranian philosopher from the 3rd century AD, who actually came up with a great idea that most religions have a sort of central truth to them. So why don't we just all get along together? Because that didn't really work in those times. What do you mean, get along together?
What a crazy idea.
What a crazy idea. We enjoy burning people at the stake.
Get the swords out.
What are you talking about? And you know, principles of Manichaeism were embedded into other, what might be called Gnostic religions, those that have a slightly more spiritual bent to them, meditative, contemplative. Even right up to the Cathars, people may well know the Cathars who were persecuted in southwest France. Mm-hmm. Well, they had elements of Manichaeism and this sort of kindness and this philosophy. Of course, you know,
they didn't end well
for them, I think. And so I'm not sure that it's necessarily the fact that, you know, people were running around with swords chasing vegetarians per se. It was more that it was an extension of what was deemed an heretical belief. You know, you had these very dogmatic scripture-based religions that were very black and white. You know, you do this, you don't do that. And then you have these other religions which say, no, let's interpret this a little more. And let's actually, there's some elements of shared thought across all these religions. That was very much a no-go for, particularly if you're wanting to retain power and control people. So you can take that pretty much up to the modern day. Although I think particularly in, you know, the Western world, we've probably lost the link between vegetarianism and religion. And I think it is much more a case of people get very upset. So, you know, if somebody is vegetarian or vegan, I think there's a worry that they're going to start talking to you about you being a bad person. How could you possibly eat animals? And there's a sense of, the second you start opening that box, I'm going to really push back at you and go into ultra-defensive mode, if you don't mind. Well, that's probably...
Yes, you have a mode of living, and therefore it has to be questioned because it threatens me and my mode of living.
There's a huge cognitive dissonance, isn't there? And I think that most people understand that, you know, in a world where you can live a really healthy diet without killing animals, it's probably not a great idea to do it. But I love my meat. I love the way it tastes. Please don't shine a mirror up to... my conflicted thoughts. Otherwise, I'm going to go to uber defensive mode and strike you off and unfollow you on social media. So, yeah.
So let's bring things a little bit more up to date. Is it correct that the UK has the world's oldest vegetarian society?
It is, absolutely.
Yours, that is.
And I am extremely privileged to lead it. So I've been here for about 18 months. And we do, and I'm always at pains to say whenever I introduce the society to people that vegetarian and veganism isn't something in the last 10 years. It's not even something of counterculture from the 60s and 70s. You know, our society has its roots in the early 19th century and some of the fights for social justice that were going on then. It was originally set up in 1847, had its roots largely in Manchester, but, you know, a coming together of thinking from London and Manchester. And really goes all the way back into the sort of late 18th and early 19th century, actually still quite closely tied to religion in this respect. But now it's actually, having said that Christians were persecuting vegetarians, it actually comes from the sort of Christian revival in the early 19th century that happens.
And you have thinking Quakers?
So you have the Quaker movement, you have the Methodist movement, all the sort of nonconformist churches coming through, slightly different ways of doing things. And what I love about the early formation of the Vegetarian Society is it's two of the prime movers in there are William Lamb and William Cowherd. So you've got Lamb and Cowherd largely responsible for the Vegetarian Society, which the irony is splendid.
Yeah, absolutely. And during the course of the Vegetarian Society's history, how has it worked? Is it a place for people to go and discuss their vegetarianism? Has it guided policy in any ways? Or is it more of an activist area? Or is it just people who like to chat about vegetables?
I think it's been through a variety of forms, but it's, as I'm always at pains to say, it is not a cosy club where we all swap recipes and pat each other on the back, telling each other how wonderful we are. it has been a campaigning and reforming organization right from the word go. That's why it was set up. It was set up, the original annals, to preach about the abstinence of flesh and its benefits. And, you know, had these very worthy Victorians getting together. If you read the original minutes, they're always at pains to say how old they are and how fit and healthy they are, because, of course, they had Punch magazine at the time really taking the mickey out of them.
Yeah.
You know, where's your beer and broth, chaps? You know, you can, a gentleman just can't exist without this. So they were always at pains to say, no, there's, you know, absolutely not. We're all fit and healthy. And even when you, you know, we have all of behind me here, where I'm sitting in the RHQ, are all of our journals going all the way back to 1847. And, you know, the stories of athletic prowess and gymnastics all the way through. But there's also a strong campaigning and educational aspect to the society. There's always been a sense that this is not an inward-facing society. It's very much an outward-facing society. What are we doing? Where are we talking? How are we advocating on behalf of animals, but on behalf of people who simply haven't come to experience a vegetarian diet yet and don't know of its benefits? Because, of course, you know, in those days, in the early 19th century, particularly in and around Salford and Manchester, where the society was forming, you know, people were existing on gruel and porridge oats. There wasn't much by way of meat. When there was, it was very poor quality. There wasn't much by way of good quality vegetables, even. You know, it was very much a dense carbohydrate-based diet. So actually...
Mainly turnips.
Mainly turnips of Blackadder fame, absolutely. And so the idea that somebody would come along, as the society used to do, and offer free vegetable soup was, you know, was a great way of bringing people in and encouraging them, maybe hopefully converting them to the benefits. But yeah, it was to sort of, you know, there's always been a side which is to show the health benefits. Animal welfare has always been extremely at the heart of the movement. And of course, you know, you come bang up today and now we've got a climate and a biodiversity crisis to think about as well, almost like the third leg of the triptych of impacts that a vegetarian and vegan diet can help to overcome.
Yeah. So along the way, has the society's guiding principles had to change to adapt to different farming techniques, animal welfare issues, and obviously now sustainability issues?
Yeah, so... For a long time, the primary objectives from an educational point of view were animal welfare and health. You could be healthier on a vegetarian diet, and actually you could be much kinder to animals. I think the aspects around animal welfare have had to change with increasing intensification and industrialization. Actually, that's in a perverse way been to the benefit of the movement, because I think a lot of people, even those who eat meat, are not in favour of intensive animal farming. They would much rather see, you know, cows wandering green pastures, chickens roaming through the fields. And of course, this slightly bucolic view of agriculture, it's not really true, even in the UK, where we have relatively higher standards. So it's actually given our campaigns a sharper edge in some respects to be able to bring some of these horrors out. And then I think from a health point of view, you know, the science has moved on. I think, you know, science in the early 19th century was, I wouldn't say in its infancy, but it wasn't much post-enlightenment, really.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we understand a lot more about the health aspects of it. And there's a couple of wonderful surveys. There's an Oxford EPIC survey, which is a cancer survey running from the 90s. But in the UK, 65,000 people have been tracked from the 90s. And vegetarians and vegans, you know, lower rates of cancer, lower rates of heart disease, lower rates of diabetes. And then the Adventists in the States, who of whom 40% are strict vegetarian because of the religion. Again, you can track those similar trends. So this is not a sort of one-off survey. These are trends that have followed through time. So again, that gives our campaigning a much sharper edge.
Changes the nature of what you want to inform
people. Well, it gives you the evidence
people.
Base, doesn't it? And then, of course, since, you know, I did my degree in the late 80s, and then, you know, at that point, James Hansen at NASA was just platforming his famous speech saying climate change is a problem, guys and girls. And now you fast forward and we've got the IPCC just issued their synthesis report just saying we're running out of time. We have got to get a grip on this. And the two primary things driving climate change are fossil fuels and land use. And by land use, they really mean agriculture and animal agriculture. So, you know, and the flip side of climate change is biodiversity loss, again, because of land use. So again, from a campaigning point of view, in terms of what we can say about the benefits of a vegetarian diet, almost in many ways, the strongest aspect of it now is actually the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis that we're facing in the early 21st century now.
It's a big fundamental shift in the message, I guess, isn't there? Let's roll back, though. What about the World Wars? How did the World Wars affect vegetarians and vegetarianism as a concept in the UK?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, you know, the First World War and the Second World War, for society to be banging on about the rights of vegetarians at the time when, don't you know, there's a war on, would seem to be fairly self-centred and self-serving. But in fact, that's exactly what the society did. And, rather a brave stance, you might say. I think the lot of the common Tommy in World War One was slightly unfortunate, very much dependent on food parcels from home rather than vegetarian rations in the trenches. But at home, there was an element of rationing in the First World War because of the U-boat blockades particularly.
Yeah.
And the war, you could exchange your meat coupons and your ration book for extra portions of bread and cheese and butter. And that was very much as a result of the Vegetarian Society's activism working with the Ministry of Food at the time. And the same in World War II. Again, advocating on behalf of citizens, 50,000 people signed up as a vegetarian during World War II to receive the appropriate ration books. They would forgo their meat ration. They would have to hand the tokens in to show that you couldn't send them on the black market to somebody else. But you'd receive extra portions of bread and powdered milk and cheese. And actually, the lot of the soldier in World War II was a little bit better. There's a wonderful section in our 1944 journal where we have written to the various ministries of the three armed forces, the RAF, the Navy, and the Army, saying, what are you doing for vegetarian soldiers? And they write back. I think the Navy is the one that's a little dragging its heels, but the Army and the RAF, interestingly, yes, no, you know, in the mess, handing in your meat, you have to identify as vegetarian, first of all, formally, but then you can have extra bread, cheese and powdered milk. Less so when you're on campaign, I think that's probably where it gets trickier. But also, of course, the society during World War II were very much behind the Dig for Victory campaign, you know, so actually turning gardens into vegetable growing plots. And so in many respects, in a perverse way, you know, the Second World War was actually a great way to advocate for and showcase the fact that a lot of people in the UK were vegetarian, whether soldiers or civilians. And, of course, a lot of people will be familiar with the idea that rationing, people who sort of ate rationed food during the war and, of course, post-war, because we had rationing up until the 50s, actually were a lot healthier. Arguably, than we are today, you know, perhaps a slightly blunder diet, but, you know, getting the correct quantities of the various food groups was a great thing. And vegetarians, experienced a healthy diet in exactly the same way.
Now, towards the end of the Second World War, the Vegan Society was established. And I wondered, how that came up. Well, you know, the splitters, obviously, how was it received by the Vegetarian Society? And was it the same sort of split as women's suffrage versus universal suffrage? Was there a sense of, like, oh, come on, we just need to achieve one thing together. And now you're saying something different. Or were they welcome with open arms?
So I think from the outside, there's definitely shades of Monty Python with the G. People's front or the people's front of Judea, but the reality is, as is ever when you get under the skin, it is slightly more complex and nuanced. So going all the way back to 1847 when the society was formed, this is the Vegetarian Society, there has always been a debate about what the correct vegetarian diet is.
I can imagine,
Does it involve milk and eggs, what we might call the lacto-ovo diet, or is it free of that, what we would now call a vegan diet? So it wasn't just in the point at which a vegan society was formed and split off that debate was having. It's been had all the way through time.
Yeah.
But basically, Donald Watson, who set up the Vegan Society, was actually a member of the Vegetarian Society and remained a member until the end of his life. He lived until around 90, I think, which is an excellent advert for a vegan diet.
There you go.
There you go. So he was writing in the Vegetarian Society journals in 1944 saying, wouldn't it be good if we, I myself follow this non-dairy vegetarian diet, as it was called. You know, great if we could have a page in the magazine dedicated to people who follow this diet. Maybe we could have a sort of separate section of the Vegetarian Society. The executive committee didn't feel this was really a thing and said, actually, we think you'd be better off maybe sort of, you know, by all means stay with us, but why not set up your own little group and advocate for it? And by hook or by crook, that's what happened. So it wasn't just Donald Watson, his wife Dorothy was involved. They were both vegans together, and he was supported by a small group of, you know, very dedicated people. So they remained within the Vegetarian Society and actually really wanted to retain that affiliation. But over time, November 1944, Donald introduces his first Vegan Society newsletter. Of course, Vegan, the name, was developed by Donald, his wife Dorothy. The story goes as a contraction of the word vegetarian. It's the beginning and the end of vegetarian, vegan. So there you go, pick the bones out of that one.
The beginning and the end.
And hence the Vegan Society was formed. You know, I think around 25 members to begin with, but obviously, you know, it's grown and developed a life of its own. And, you know, and together we exist, you know, complementary to each other in some ways. The Vegan Society is dedicated to veganism. Vegetarian Society is dedicated to vegetarianism and veganism. You know, we are a broad church. And I think increasingly, at least certainly under my tenure here, you know, I want us to be an organisation that is open for business for concerned meaters and flexitarians at the same time.
Well, I was going to say, how broad is the church? Yeah, is flexitarianism, is that sort of, you know, letting in the enemy a little bit too much? And again, the sort of lacto ovo, and where do you draw the line? Does a line have to be drawn, I guess, is the question.
No, there is no line, not in my philosophy, because otherwise, you know, we are that cosy club of vegetarians. We assume somebody else does all the work of inspiring people to change their diet, and then they come to us once they've changed. That's not the society we are, nor is it the society we've ever been. You know, we have to be out there in the outside world campaigning and educating. And I very much want people who are still eating meat but are concerned and thinking and looking for guidance about reducing their meat, or those who, I'm not sure how many people really walk around saying, I'm a flexitarian.
It's such
a
horrible
word,
isn't it?
Yeah. Even in the States, there's an organization called the Reducitarian Foundation, which takes it a step further. But I would love people to come close to the society, to sign up for our newsletter, think about becoming members, because, you know, 9 out of 10 people in this country are still eating meat and fish and dairy. And I believe our job is to inspire them, not to cajole them, not to finger point, not to jab them in the forehead and tell them what dreadful people they are.
That was the old way,
to do it. Yeah, absolutely.
Kick them,
jab in the forehead, pin them in a corner. No, you know, we need to demonstrate that it's an inspiring diet. It's, you know, the foods you're going to eat are absolutely fantastic. You will have fantastic nutrition. You will be healthier than you could ever imagine. And you'll be doing good. You'll be doing your bit at the same time. So, yeah, we are very much a broad church organisation. And that's the way I think we will always be.
Yeah. So since the war, who have been some of the key figures in bringing vegetarianism to the masses? Who should we look at as sort of guiding lights?
It's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because for many people, sort of vegetarianism really kicked off in the counterculture 60s and the 70s. You know, the Vietnam War, clearly a lot of protests going on then. You've got a number of food writers who are coming along at that time. But I think primarily, if you were to pick anyone who was well-known, you would say Linda and Paul McCartney. And I'm saying very deliberately in that order, Linda McCartney followed by Paul McCartney, because it was Linda who dragged Paul along. And I think if you were to say, who is the vegetarian icon from the 70s or even post-war, I think you'd have to say it was Linda McCartney. Because, you know, it obviously helps when you're married to Paul McCartney, let's be honest. But, you know, Paul McCartney himself became vegetarian and is increasingly vegan now. And he's our patron. Actually, he's a patron of the Vegetarian Society, which we're thrilled to have him and Stella and Mary, his, you know, both of his daughters as patrons of the society. But I think if you're talking about people who bring it to a mass market, then it has to be Linda and Paul. You know, they wrote cookbooks. They obviously used their platform. And this is in a pre-social media age, of course, to really raise the profile of vegetarianism and make it more mainstream. And then, you know, they go on further and set up Linda McCartney Foods and actually start to take what you might call the processed type vegetarian food, the sausages and the burgers and the nuggets, out of the dusty health food shop down a dodgy back street in a town into mainstream supermarkets in the 90s.
Yeah. And I think and making a big business out of it as well, which is
really
exciting.
Making a huge business out of it and becoming, you know, I think together with Quorn, Q-U-O-R-N, becoming, particularly in the 90s, one of the two big pioneers of, yeah, of vegetarian food that looked and felt familiar to meat eaters. I think it was fair to say.
We slightly irrelevant but interesting point here is I have a small TV studio as part of my house, and Mary McCartney was filming a TV series here, and Paul was coming in. We had to remove all of the, you know, the stuffed boar and all these things,
of course,
from the house,
of course,
for
yes,
Mary.
Absolutely.
But when Paul came up, he actually used our bedroom as his dressing room, and we had to remove everything that was made of leather and all the sheepskin rugs. And, you know, quite right too. And it's only when things, you know, a light like that is shone on your life that you kind of go, my house is full of these things as well. So interesting.
That's the beauty. I think, you know, more and more I would always say vegetarian and veganism is more than a diet, and it's more of a philosophy. So it almost goes back to that Pythagoras moment and the Buddha that we started off from. You know, look around you and think the leather city is actually the skin of a fellow animal that you've had dressed. The wool is the what was once on a sheep wandering around. So I think it does challenge you to think and go beyond the diet. A fun fact, not necessarily a mainstream audience, but Peter Cushing of horror film fame was a lifelong vegetarian, and it was also our general secretary for quite some time. So below the sort of Linda and Paul McCartneys, there are a number of other, actors in the broadest sense of the word, who may not have been shouting about their vegetarianism, but for them it was very much central to their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is a food industry podcast, so I'd like to sort of shift your thoughts towards the food industry. Now, if we look at today's world, industrialization, globalization has had immeasurable impacts on the food industry. But how has vegetarianism shaped or been shaped by the modern food industry?
That's a very interesting question, isn't it? I think it both is the simple answer. I think the rise of vegetarianism, but I think more recently the rise of veganism, is really shaping, you know, I always like to say, 5-6 years ago, there was no such thing as the plant-based aisle in your local supermarket.
Yeah.
And now if you go to any of the big four, even the big seven, you know, M&S, Lidl and Aldi, they've all got plant-based sections in there, some bigger than others, but that simply wasn't a thing. And what you're seeing is, absolutely, you can go to the section where there's a very traditional tofu or seitan or tempeh, but now you're seeing a huge range. I mean, most people have heard of, you know, the Impossible Burger and some of these other things that are coming through. And
Some of them are very, very good.
Very good. And, you know, I'm sure we'll come on to the concerns around them as well that get exercised from a health point of view. But from my point of view, I'm a huge advocate of them because, you know, if you want to really broaden the appeal of vegetarianism and veganism, then, you know, allow barbecue man to stand next to his friends frying, you know, barbecuing something that looks like a burger or a sausage and actually tastes like a burger or sausage.
And also, I think that the big shift that I saw that I thought made a massive difference was not just the vegetarian aisle, but the fact that at some level, the vegetarian aisle has shifted, and now you get this integration where you get vegan and vegetarian products in the shelves amongst the burgers. So you'll see the burgers, but right next to them are the vegan burgers as well. And I think that that's a more interesting, nuanced shift that may be more important than the vegetarian aisle. Because, as you say, you got people using the same grill, they're standing there together, enjoying the same sorts of foods, and maybe that's a gear shift in accepting vegetarianism.
I completely agree. And it's almost like a natural progression, isn't it? Because, you know, my vision is that, you know, in 10 or 15 years' time, there's a tiny meat-based section for those reactionaries who are still demanding meat no matter what.
Table's turn, yes.
But actually, the rest of the supermarket is just vegetarian and vegan. It's just, you know, it becomes de facto the norm. But you're right, you know, sometimes you will go and see, I don't know if I'm allowed to name brands or name, but like Richmond's, you know, you'll see Richmond's meat sausages next to the Richmond's vegan sausages. And, you know, I think most people accept that actually that when it comes to sausages, you know, Quorn, Linda McCartney, Richmond's have really changed the game when it comes to that. But I think on the other side, you know, the food industry, if you look at the way that thinking about the more traditional vegetarian foods like beans and pulses and peas, the fact that you can now get an enormous range of beans canned very easily, you know, no soaking for 12 hours overnight anymore. And I always say to new vegetarians that it isn't just about the plant-based section and the new burgers and sausages. You know, spend a while in the fruit and veg section. Don't just grab the carrots and the broccoli and walk off. Have a look at what else is there and experiment. And actually, when you get to the section where you've got your beans and pulses, don't just grab a can of baked beans. You know, I mean, there's bolotti beans, pinto beans. Yeah. You know,
there's an adventure still to be had there.
Adventure. And that's the way I always encourage people to look at it. I really don't like the term meat-free because it suggests that you're giving something up. I'd not long started, and Justin Welby, bless him, the Archbishop of Canterbury, said he was giving up meat and he saw it as a sacrifice that he was willing to make. I thought, what an absolutely dreadful framing. You know,
you want to see it as a positive move forward.
As a positive move. Yes, okay, you are de facto giving something up, but see it as, no, I'm actually bringing a whole range of new foods into my life. And, you know, I think if we get that framing right, again, my job is to inspire people to come along on this journey, not make them feel like they have to put a hair shirt on and drag themselves along on this journey.
Now, I think you alluded to it just now, but where do you stand on vegetarian food that tries to mimic meat? Are you broadly in acceptance that it draws people into a new way of thinking, or does it cause its own problems?
I am a huge advocate for it, and that's not always popular, even with my own society. You know, we do have some very traditional vegetarians and vegans who don't quite like the rays of processed meats, would much prefer that we have a whole foods diet, arguably is healthier. But my view is that there's a job of work to do to get the sort of 90% plus of people who are still eating meat over the line to start reducing their meat. And for me, it's much easier if you give them something familiar. You know, if you can have a spag bol, but you're just using your plant-based mince instead of a meat mince and it tastes fantastic, I'm up for it. If you could have a burger or a sausage in a bun with a dressing on, and actually I can't tell the difference, I'm there. You know, one of my favourite meals is, steak, fries and green beans, and I can have a fantastic plant-based steak. We've served it to friends, actually, for us to come around and say, come on, we'll give you a steak dinner. And they've loved it. And that's the funny thing, that, you know, they can tell it's not a steak, obviously. But it's like, that's actually not bad. Do you know, that's not bad. And so, yeah, I'm a big advocate of it. I think it's a real game changer. And if you look at the billions that are being pumped in, you know, Israel and Singapore, because obviously quite low regulatory regimes, a lot of stuff is coming out of there. But in the US and the UK as well, you know, there's a huge expansion of it. And we talked earlier about the fact that, you know, 5-6 years ago, a lot of these products weren't really on supermarket shelves. I always say to people, fast forward 5 years or 10 years, just imagine what there's going to be there. And you know, before we even get on to cultivated meat, which is a different thing altogether. But yeah, huge advocate of them. I think they're real game changers.
Yeah, absolutely. And now my last question really is, do you feel that there's an inevitability to vegetarianism? I mean, there are lots of different tools that the government can use. We need to move towards sustainability goals. I think it's not going to be that long before, you know, sustainability taxes come in and that it's got to have a financial incentive. Otherwise, you know, businesses simply won't bother. Do you think it's inevitable and that one day we will all be vegetarian?
That's a very good question. I think it's inevitable that we will have to have a seismic transformation of our food system. Now, does that mean that the whole world will be vegetarian? Possibly not, actually, because there are advances. So I talked a little earlier about cultivated meat. So this is the idea of cell-grown meat. You know, certain newspapers will call it Frankenstein food. You know, it's lab meat. But the reality is, I think the chair of Tesco was on record saying that, you know, he sees in a few years' time a future whereby cell-based meat is the basis for all of the processed meats that we use. Yeah, okay, it won't create a steak, but, you know, a lot of processed meat is used in ready meals particularly. So why not use this cell-based meat instead of slaughtering animals to do it? So I think we will have a big transformation in our food system. I think we will be much more, and it, you know, the phrase that's used is plant forward. We will be much more plant forward.
Yeah.
So plant-based proteins, I think, will be the norm without a doubt. But I just think it's exciting. So will the world be vegetarian? Possibly not. Will we have a world where we don't depend on animal farming and slaughter? Almost certainly, I think. I think you will have an element of lab-grown meat that serves the need of people who simply can't get themselves off meat for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But that's great. You know, rather than wasting 80% of my time trying to convert the 20% of people who really aren't listening, just give them some meat. But it's not coming from a farmed and slaughtered animal. Meanwhile, you know, let's get on with really boosting the plant-based world. You know, you look at what we do in the UK, we talk about food security. You know, we feed half of the grains, the cereals, the fodder crops that we produce to animals. If we simply rediverted that and fed it to ourselves, we could be far more food secure. You look at the shocks that the Ukraine war and COVID have had on the food supply system. You know, why are we not doing this when actually feeding a cow to produce protein is fairly well recognized, but incredibly inefficient way of producing protein. You know, you get very little out for an awful lot in. So, yeah, so I think my vision for the world is one where we no longer farm animals for meat. We can repurpose all of that land for rewilding and carbon capture and biodiversity and ecotourism and all these wonderful things that aren't with us yet necessarily. We are eating far more fruits and vegetables and grains. We are eating a lot more really interesting plant proteins. So lots of beans and pulses, very traditional, but actually a lot of the foods that are coming through that you see in the supermarkets, whether it's burgers, sausages, steaks, will get better and better and better.
Yeah.
We'll be eating more of those. And as I say, for the people who simply can't give up meat, yeah, well, okay, you can have meat. It'll be cultivated meat. It won't come from an animal. And I think the argument then is, no, I demand it must come from an animal and I want it slaughtered. Kind of, that's going to be a pretty difficult argument to make.
Yeah, so, absolutely. You know, we're going to look back at one day and go, did we do that?
Do you know, I think we will. Did we really cover 70% of habitable land in animals and then slaughter them well before their natural age, to eat a diet that the World Health Organization has in some ways linked to ill health and cancers, particularly with red meat and processed meats? Did we really do that? Did we think that was a good idea? I like to think that I think we're on the cusp of a massive transformation, and that's uncomfortable for people. Change is uncomfortable. You know, we were hunter-gatherers for a long time. We've been farmers for an awful long time. We will continue to be farmers. But I would very much see a world where the animal farming side of it has gone. We treat animals with respect. You know, we've just passed in this country last year the Animal Sentience Bill, now an act, which recognises that a huge range of animals, from pigs and cows all the way down to octopus and crustaceans, are sentient. We just haven't done anything about it yet. So I do think, and that leads you all the way back to the 6th century BC and Pythagoras, bless him. You know, he was there saying animals are sentient, we should be treating them differently, we shouldn't be killing them. And who knows, maybe in the 21st century we might actually get ourselves over the line and Pythagoras would be proud.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's coming our way. There's change coming, and as you say, I think that change will be seismic. What's really exciting talking to you about it is that it's an optimistic future, that it's a positive thing, and that it could be really exciting. So let's hope it's an adventure, and let's hope the vegetarian future tastes bloody good as well.
Let's hope so. Yeah, it does now. Let's hope it tastes better.
Okay, we'll go for that. Fantastic. Well, Richard McElwain, thank you so much for your incredible font of knowledge. Thank you so much for joining me.
Very welcome. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.